critically analyzing global affairs. This is the Hervoy Moritz Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, hour three, quick news. Again, U.S. State Department official says Russia will face serious consequences if it goes ahead with the referendum process in Ukraine. We're waiting for Putin's speech, 8 or 9 a.m. Moscow time. Today, tomorrow, depends where you are on the planet. And as well, German Chancellor Olaf Scholz is, quote, very irritated about Turkey's attempts to join the SCO, the Central Asian Security Body dominated by Russia and China. We've got some unhappy campers in the Western Hemisphere. The multipolar world is multipolaring. We had, in my hometown of Chicago, an explosion that ripped through the top floor of an apartment building. Is that just another example of the third worldization of America? I don't know, but not good news. There's that, and we have Europe. WSJ, Wall Street Journal, reporting how Europe is running out of safe assets. German debt has become massively overbid, underscoring the panic over the Eurozone's economic outlook. So investors have a problem. It says the ECB raises interest rates and the Eurozone economy edges closer to a recession. They may not have enough places to hide. I would normally be hiding in the Croatian kuna, but that's going to cease to exist in about 3 months, and we're going to be forced to take on the euro. And so it says basically the fact these disruptions are flaring up now sends a concerning message. European markets are getting panicky. So everywhere we look, things are not good. And Tuomas Malinen, Finnish economist, who I've had on my Geopolitics and Empire podcast a couple times, does fantastic work. He's on Epoch Times talking about how the EU is about to rupture. If you ask me as an EU citizen, I will tell you good riddance. So he's basically saying that two things might happen. The EU disintegrates completely, or it mutates into something unrecognizable to its original purpose. So many people keep saying this that I interview, even European intellectuals. So yeah, that's an interesting road ahead there. Things just do not look good for the EU any which way you cut it, economically, politically, security-wise. So that's interesting. Apparently, Facebook, a new report has revealed that Facebook has removed fake accounts suspected of being used by the U.S. military for secret psychological operations. This prompted the Pentagon to order an audit of how the DoD conducts secret information warfare online. I have firsthand experience with all of that. You know the story, getting taken down by Patreon, having my podcast mentioned in the Associated Press, in an article co-written by NATO's think tank, the Atlantic Council, and having my Patreon soon after that terminated, and having my PayPal, I think, taken down by the DHS. And so, yes, I am on the front lines of the Pentagon information war. What else is going on? The Pentagon is pushing defense companies to limit their use of Chinese supplies. So that we see the Pentagon intensifying efforts to decouple U.S. defense companies from the Chinese supply chain, which makes sense, completely logical, although I guess a difficult thing to do. And apparently half of all Bitcoin transactions are fake, a new study finds. I wonder if MicroStrategy's Michael Saylor's recent purchase of, was it 300 Bitcoins, was fake or not. So, that's most of the news that I've found interesting, and a reminder again that if you've got an upcoming community event, rally, march, festival, fundraiser that could do with some free publicity, TNT Radio can promote it for you. Just visit the What's On events calendar on TNTRadio.live, submit your event details, and we'll try and get the word out on TNT Radio.
Count on us to deliver the facts.
I can rely on that.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
All right, returning to the program is Alan Tonelson of Reality Check, the blog, and for some reason I didn't put the link, but here's the link. Alan Tonelson, that's AlanTonelson .wordpress.com. You'll find him on Twitter as well. He's got a super long bio, which you can find on the website. He's been all over the place. Welcome back to TNT, Alan.
It's great to be here, and thanks for the invite.
Yeah, and how are you holding out in these interesting times?
Well, the most important development that I can report, and it's been true for the last 2.5 years, is that my family and my closest relatives and closest friends, and even most of their friends, have been completely and blessedly unaffected by the coronavirus pandemic. And we are absolutely thrilled to hear or to have heard President Biden declare the other night that the pandemic phase is over. Our hearts, of course, go out to all victims and all of their loved ones, but we just have dodged this major bullet, and we could not be more grateful.
You're probably getting a lot of sun, vitamin D, and vitamin C, and eating well, and not stressing out. But I really do hope it's over, although I'm kind of worried. Many countries have removed their restrictions. New Zealand, I was just reading, Netherlands have removed it. Spain is just removing, all of those controls, like requiring PCR tests for entry at ports. There's talk of the Arrive Can in Canada being taken down. But this one outlier, Germany, apparently in a week is going to require, they're reinstating the biosecurity regime. They're going to have masks and little social credit app system to manage that. Any thought on that?
Well, that's awfully strange, given that because of the energy crisis that looms before it this winter, Germany is going to have more than its share of problems, and certainly doesn't need yet another possible source of political and social, not to mention economic instability. I just don't know what they're thinking.
Me neither. I'm trying to crack that code. Maybe later we can get into energy and economy. But, one of the reasons I asked you on, I had recently had Daniel McCarthy of Modern Age, a journal on the program. He wrote the foreword for a reissue by Regnery of Wilmore Kendall's Conservative Affirmation. And apparently Wilmore is the philosopher of right-wing populism. I had no idea. I got the book, and so I'm learning a lot. But I noticed Daniel had been at the National Conservatism Conference, which I didn't even know exist. NatsCon 3. I saw some of the photos, and you were there as well. And you recently wrote a sobering, fascinating piece on your blog that I follow, subscribe to, a new, promising but still flawed form of conservatism. And I thought, that'd be interesting for our listeners to get into, and maybe look at, have you get your thoughts on some of the promises and flaws that you detect?
Well, sure. I was so pleased to have been invited to that conference, because there were so many outstanding speakers making so many important points about so many ongoing problems that the United States faces, both in terms of its national security, in terms of its social cohesion, in terms of how of maintaining a functioning political system, and on and on and on. And at the same time, I came away from the conference with very mixed feelings, mainly because, as I wrote in that post on my Reality Check blog, I am deeply concerned, not that national conservatism, which this new movement calls it, is determined to fight culture wars. I think there are certainly culture wars that need to be fought because of the just bonkers excesses of the increasingly authoritarian left that we've been seeing, not only since President Biden was inaugurated, but for years before that. So there are definitely culture wars that need to be fought. But I'm afraid that, at least judging from some of the speakers in this conference, and even judging by the manifesto that some of the movement's leaders recently put out, I'm afraid that national conservatism is also fighting some of the wrong culture wars. In particular, these folks seem to be very determined to label this movement as what they call Christian nationalism. And not that I have anything against Christianity, and certainly not that I have anything against nationalism, but this notion, I fear, is leading many of these national conservatives to support very extreme, very intolerant, and also politically very unpromising stances on questions like abortion and on questions like gay marriage. And I'm hoping that somehow these views can be cashiered sometime in the next few weeks or months. But that's going to be a long slog for those of us who would like to see national conservatism and conservatism, generally speaking, veer in what we would regard as a much more productive and much more promising direction.
I mean, there's a number of issues here. I think one that stood out is, I think you pointed it out, but I see consistently other people pointing this out as well, that the left seems to be organized, this authoritarian left that you're mentioning that's just gone off the rails with cancel culture, wokeism, the transgender stuff, just shoving this down everyone's throats, messing with the kids, which they shouldn't be. But that this conservatism today is not unified. It's all over the place. You know, how do you see that?
Well, I would follow up the remarks that I just made by pointing out that that whatever one thinks from a moral or from an ethical or from a religious perspective, going after abortion rights, and this, of course, applies to the very long, drawn-out campaign that many conservatives waged for years to overturn Roe versus Wade, despite that long and of course, ultimately successful so far campaign. The great majority of the American people are not with them, and the same goes for any possible moves that are being contemplated to restrict or much less ban gay marriage. Those might have been winning political positions in the 1950s and 1960s and even through the 1990s, but they're certainly not winning political positions now. And the overriding concern that I have is that those stances are going to alienate so many potential converts to the rest of national conservatism that it's going to prevent that movement and various movements allied with it from making the kind of progress that we need in the culture wars that do need to be fought.
How would you then recommend or that those two issues, abortion and gay marriage, be treated by the movement? They just focus on other issues or what?
Well, at this point, I think they're going to have to renounce any objective or any determination to restrict gay marriage, which of course is still the law of the land according to the Supreme Court. And unfortunately, I think it's now too late for them simply to be quiet about abortion because of that Dobbs decision that the court did hand it down. I think they're going to have to actually, and this is very difficult for any political figure to do, let me tell you, they're going to have to actually renounce positions that they've stood for a long, long time. And it's not easy. But again, if national conservatism is going to win converts, is going to gain support that it doesn't have already, let alone become the kernel of a winning coalition in American politics, I'm afraid nothing less is going to be required. And in fact, what national conservatives ought to acknowledge in this process is that Roe versus Wade got it right. Roe versus Wade got it right. Roe versus Wade struck exactly the kind of compromise position, generally speaking, that most Americans back today. It did not establish an untrammeled, unfettered national right to an abortion. It did not establish an unfettered, limitless right to privacy. It said that as the pregnancy moves forward, that the state has a very compelling interest in protecting that budding human life, but that in the early stages, that compelling interest simply does not exist. And of course, the main test used is, I guess, very simplistically speaking, viability, but it's a common sense test. And it's one that most Americans back very strongly. They don't back a limitless right to an abortion. They don't want abortion bans. They don't want excessive restrictions. They want bans or very strict curbs early during pregnancies, or I should say they want a very wide-ranging right or scope to have an abortion very early during pregnancies. And as pregnancies advance, they want more and more limits. And that's exactly what Roe provided for. That's exactly what conservatives ought to be supporting. And by the way, Roe also left plenty of latitude precisely because of that framework that it laid out. It left plenty of latitude for individual states to enact rather strict curbs on abortion, especially later during pregnancies. What was the problem?
Well, we're going to have to jump, hold that thought, Alan, to our first break. And again, people can find Alan on Twitter at Alan Tonelson. That's AlanTonelson. And we'll be right back on TNT Radio.
Christina Borgeson on TNT Radio.
3 months after being appointed CIA director in 2017, Mike Pompeo gave a speech in which he said, quote, "It's time to call out WikiLeaks for what it really is, a non-state hostile intelligence service often abetted by state actors in Russia." In January of this year, our intelligence community determined that Russian military intelligence, the GRU, had used WikiLeaks to release data of U.S. victims that the GRU had obtained through cyber operations against the Democratic National Committee. That's all Mike Pompeo talking here. Actually, even today, no proof of this particular allegation by Mr. Pompeo has ever seen the light of day. His characterization of WikiLeaks, which has always been a media organization whose work product was widely picked up and published in other major media outlets, is also inaccurate. Nonetheless, Pompeo and the U.S. intelligence community, aided and abetted by operatives in other nations, has led a ruthless, relentless international intelligence community operation to all but kill WikiLeaks editor-in-chief Julian Assange.
Christina Borgeson on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Let's take advantage of the freedoms that we have while we have them to advance the kingdom's objective, to be salt and light.
Freedom is hard. Election security involves you, involves the voters.
This election for people of faith is vital that we see a change, because the war against Christians is at an all-time high.
Transparency is the key not only to having honest elections, but to maintaining public trust in those elections.
Our ability to vote is not being withheld from us. No one's trying to stop you from voting.
The one place the American people can have a say is at the ballot box. That's why the Democrats and the far left are working so hard to get rid of all election integrity.
We cannot let our elections be anything but transparent. It is at the very heart of freedom in a free society.
And if we lose America, I mean, it's all over, because the world has looked to America for hope.
Free and fair at salemnow.com.
News more twisted than soap operas.
Ugh.
And with worse actors.
You can't be serious.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
And we're back with Alan Tonelson of alantonelson.wordpress.com. And, you know, there's some things I agree with and disagree with. I'm pretty not a fan of abortion or gay marriage. But then I would agree that the hour does seem late. And I've never really thought through in the political sense how to deal with these things. And as well as Christian nationalism, something doesn't sit right with that. For me, myself as a Christian, I always viewed just faith and the state to be separate. I mean, if we look at the New Testament and Jesus's interactions with the Roman
Empire. Christianity itself preaches that.
Yeah, I mean, it's just the whole point from my perspective is you preach the gospel to people. You're not forcing it down people's throats. You know, they reject it, they reject it. But it's more at a social level. And there seems to be this movement. I don't know if you've been following it closer, but there seems to be this growing movement in the U.S. You've got people like Gab and Andrew Torba. I think he just published a book on Christian nationalism. Have you looked at that at all?
I haven't seen that, but I remain convinced that this is an enormous and very counterproductive distraction that this national conservative movement seems to be indulging in.
Yeah, and I'm afraid, you know, going into 2024, if Trump comes back and wins, it could go down some scary pathways as well. I guess we'll just have to see. You know, authoritarianism could be in play. You know, reaction to, you know, we're in this sort of left authoritarianism. It could also swing right in the other direction. And you know, any other thoughts from NatCon 3? Ron DeSantis was there. There's talk of him running for president. You know, any other issues?
Ron DeSantis gave an absolute powerhouse speech. And P.S., he didn't say much, if anything, about abortion, and he didn't say much, if anything, about Christian. In fact, he said nothing about Christian nationalism. That phrase did not pass his lips at all. And by the way, ditto for Marco Rubio, who also gave a very effective talk. But certainly Ron DeSantis was the rock star of that conference, and he got a roaring standing ovation as he stepped to the podium. And he was introduced, and I think this is very interesting, he was introduced as the next president of the United States. Now, that might have been the MC getting a little carried away with himself, but the folks in attendance, and at that point, there were probably nearly 900 people that were in that room, they were very enthusiastic.
There have been a number of people, I think most recently Alex Jones, who carries a lot of weight, saying he's disowning Trump and going for Ron DeSantis. So maybe some people are pivoting away from Trump and towards DeSantis. And I maybe to get your thoughts, a few weeks ago we had Biden's, I call it V for Vendetta speech, sure, as many people do. Some people compare it to, you know, 1930s Germany, the red and black, you know, background, and calling half the country extremist. And I also think it's valuable to point out, right before that speech, the governor of New York, Hochul, also did something similar, where she said all Republicans should leave New York. And again, I studied at the Geneva School of Diplomacy. This is no way for any politician to be speaking,
right,
whether they're Democrat or Republican. And it's kind of getting scary because they're using, you know, this they're talking about domestic terror and just causing more problems for what otherwise are normal Americans, you know, who aren't doing anything wrong. But there's this tendency towards authoritarianism. What's sort of your reaction to that speech and maybe some things we've seen since?
Well, first of all, let me say, I don't think that what Alex Jones says or doesn't say or who he endorses or not is going to move the needle one fraction of one millimeter during this this midterm election campaign, much less the election 2024. But having said that, what I find most dangerous about this left-wing authoritarianism, which is by no means confined to the crazy extreme left, it's by no means confined to Antifa, it's by no means confined to the so-called squad, and it's not even that many of its core tenets clearly have been picked up by more centrist or formerly centrist moderate Democratic leaders like President Biden, but that some version of this is backed strongly by virtually every single powerful institution in this country, from Wall Street to Silicon Valley to Hollywood to the Fortune 500 to the academic world, to the public education establishment, the public health establishment. I mean, this is really, really scary. And again, that's why it is so terribly important, in fact, vital for conservatives and for moderates and for liberals who really believe in tolerance and in representative democracy to choose the right culture wars and not become distracted by political positions and crusades that are just out and out losers.
All right, we're going to have to take a quick news break. We'll be right back.
This is James O'Neill with a check of today's headlines. President Biden declared in a TV interview that the pandemic is over. Britain's newly appointed Prime Minister Liz Truss has publicly admitted that there is little chance of a UK-US trade deal being signed anytime soon. New York City has announced it's ending its COVID vaccine mandate for private sector companies in November. However, other city employees will still be required to get a jab, while hundreds of other workers who refused are in the process of being fired.
If you miss your favorite TNT radio show or interview, simply listen back when you want, wherever you want. Just visit episodes on the TNT radio website. We're also on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Google, Spotify, Amazon, Podbean, iHeart, and TuneIn. Now there's no reason to miss out on anything on TNT radio.
And maybe to get sort of your measured forecast going forward, we get the primaries and later the election. I'm picking up some signals. We had Rand Paul recently grilling Fauci again, saying, you know, when we get back in power, the Republicans, I guess he's alluding to the coming months, he's going to go after Fauci. We saw in Sweden, a right-wing party that has now come to power, and Pierre, up in Canada, Pierre, whose last name I can't pronounce, has won leadership of the Conservative Party. And so there seems to be some momentum building. You know, any further thoughts here?
I am completely convinced, though, that unless there's some major backlash in the United States that expresses itself politically, both in these upcoming midterm elections and also in the presidential election in 2024, I'm not sure that that whatever reactions we're seeing throughout Europe are really going to amount to very much, because I don't think they're going to be terribly lasting. I think that in some clearly informal, inchoate sense, I do think that to some extent, European politics does take its cue from U.S. politics. And so, again, it is vitally important that common sense and toleration be restored to American politics. And that means that there's a great deal of work to do among left of center U.S. leaders, but there's also a great deal to do among right of center U.S. leaders.
Fair enough. And I would agree with you on the many people looking to the United States on many aspects, even the COVID policies that, you know, the U.S. did, you know, Mexico, everyone else sort of follows is the CDC and whatnot leading the charge. And maybe to turn a little bit towards energy and economy, you were discussing the situation in Europe, and things are getting pretty bad. I've been here in Europe the last couple of months, and when I first came, I just one simple example, I bought a mobile SIM card, and since I bought it, it's the price, the monthly price has gone up twice by like a dollar and a half each time, which for you know, a SIM card is not something cheap. And so you're seeing it's getting you know, pretty crazy. We've seen in France and Germany, gas prices, electricity prices go up 1,000%. Businesses going out of business. There was a bakery in Germany that was paying 10,000 euros in electricity. Now it's paying 20,000 euros, and they got a close shop. And so, you know, what are some things you've been looking at in terms of energy and inflation and the economy?
What I keep thinking lately, and I'll probably write about this shortly, is that there is emerging a tremendous irony surrounding this Ukraine war and Western and particularly U.S. policy. And here's the irony. On the one hand, the very substantial Western military and also economic aid to Ukraine's resistance has been justified largely by claiming that if Russia succeeds to any significant extent, that that global stability, that the rules-based global order that allegedly has been in place since the end of World War II, and which again allegedly has prevented great power war and all of the horrors that go with it, this rules-based order will be fatally undermined, and global politics will be entering a new and much more dangerous phase. And what's ironic about this is that it's the very duration of this Ukraine war, the fact that it's lasted since late February, and all of the disruptions in not only European energy supplies, but global energy supplies and global food supplies also, especially in areas like Africa and the Middle East that relied very heavily on Ukraine in particular for supplies of grain. The very length of this war is also profoundly destabilizing Europe, as we see in all the economic reports coming out of that continent. And it's very profoundly stabilizing vast areas outside Europe either. So again, it really does strike me that if this war lasts much longer, even if it doesn't go nuclear, or even if weapons of mass destruction of other kinds aren't used, that precisely because, and I do blame Western and in particular U.S. leaders here, because there has been so little interest in coming to some kind of compromise and preventing those weapons of mass destruction related catastrophes, we're going to get very high and potentially dangerous levels of European and global instability anyway.
Yeah, I would agree. And it seems the biggest loser, again, it's like century after century, is Europe. Pretty much everyone I talk to or everything that I read, it seems like Europe is going to suffer the most. And it seems the U.S. is maybe more resilient because of its geography, the size of its economy, and everything. I think you were looking recently into inflation in the U.S. I mean, would you agree that Europe will suffer the worst? Because it seems like the East is coming together. We had the recent SCO, Shanghai Cooperation Organization meeting, which some say was the most important SCO meeting ever. We had Erdogan, Xi Jinping. Actually, there was a clip of Putin and Erdogan arm in arm walking together, and Xi Jinping and Narendra Modi was there. And so what's let's say nukes don't go off. How do you see things then?
I'm really not so terribly worried about the so-called SCO countries. I find Russia, for obvious reasons, monumentally unimpressive. I find Turkey monumentally unimpressive. I mean, it's constantly inflation-plagued, inflation-ridden, governed in a completely incompetent manner economically. I find Iran monumentally unimpressive. China's the only actor in that coalition that really counts. And frankly, China doesn't need the other three very much at all. And we have our own problems with China, naturally, and we have to deal with our own challenges from China, irrespective of whatever dictatorships it happens to be playing footsie with at the moment. But there's no doubt that the United States is in a much better position regarding all of these global, both economic and strategic shocks than Europe, precisely because we are so actually and even more so potentially completely self-sufficient in energy and in food. And of course, we are shielded from all of our major actual and potential adversaries by thousands of miles of ocean. And we've got a lot of nuclear weapons that we can very credibly threaten them with if they make any move to attack us. So even though U.S. leaders for decades have seemed determined to squander most of these advantages of very high levels of self-sufficiency, this country is still in very good shape. And in fact, as I've written, U.S. foreign policy should mainly focus on capitalizing and augmenting those advantages, not squandering them.
Yeah, those are some good points. And it's interesting because I read everything from all perspectives, and it's and you know, you get influenced by a lot of these different things you read. It's sort of like the wind, you blow back and forth between different perspectives. But there are these Russophiles that are building, hyping up this multipolar world to, I think, a bit too much. And you sort of brought things down a bit to the ground. And I recall living in the former Soviet Union in Kazakhstan. I've been to Russia, and mm-hmm. I think, as you say, you brought up some good points that there are huge differences between, you know, the two worlds of the West and the East, and all these different problems that plague the Turkey. And I think you're right to focus on China. I know you recently had a chat with John Batchelor, who has a great mm-hmm. show, and with Gordon Chang. I haven't had time to listen to that yet, but y'all were talking about China and manufacturing. I recently spoke to Greg Copley of International Strategic Studies Association mm-hmm. on, you know, he thinks China is doing their lockdowns because they have economic woes, and, you know, it could be related to some of the economic issues, maybe even population control, maybe even preparations for war. But, you know, what are some other interesting points related to China and manufacturing? I think you posted a recent piece, I think, on Twitter, the Pentagon wanting to decouple the supply chain related to defense. You know, what's some interesting things or takeaways from that discussion?
Sure. Well, what I highlighted in one of my reality check posts earlier today was a finding that was contained in a Wall Street Journal article that the number of Chinese entities, and I use that word advisedly, I don't want to call them Chinese companies, I don't want to call them Chinese businesses, and I don't think anybody should, because they have absolutely nothing in common with companies and businesses in free market countries. But the point is that the number of Chinese entities on the U.S. Defense Department's list of suppliers of weapons and also defense-related goods has quintupled between the year 2012 and the year 2019, which is apparently the last reliable data that's available. And although I was aware that there was way too much reliance in the U.S. defense manufacturing base on products from China, I found that data to be truly shocking. And it's quite sobering that even though former President Trump spent 4 years trying to alert, and I think largely successfully, the American political system to the major threat posed by China, and took the first steps toward decoupling, as the phrase goes, the U.S. from the Chinese economy, we have so much more work that needs to be done. And I'm not really sure that time is on our side to the degree that that there's real doubt, it seems, in the U.S. national security community that if push comes to shove in the Taiwan Straits and the U.S. and China come to blows, that U.S. victory is by no means guaranteed here. And that's so critically important because Taiwan is the world's leader in manufacturing the world's most advanced semiconductors, which, of course, are the electronic hearts of practically every good that we consume, defense-related and also not. And it's also at the heart of practically every service that gets provided to us.
Yeah, I think if anyone was considering purchasing a cell phone, laptop, or desktop, or whatnot, now would be a good time. There was a funny tweet.
Sure.
there was a funny comment on Twitter. Apparently, Kanye West. They said Kanye West was helping America decouple from China because apparently he's working with Gap, and he terminated his deal because he wanted to do manufacturing in America. But I guess they were doing it in China. So it's funny, Kanye West is leading the way in decoupling from.
We need all the help we can get on this score.
Yeah. We're going to jump to our last break. Again, you can find Alan. His website is Alan Tonelson. That's Alan, TONELSON, .wordpress.com. We'll be right back on TNT Radio.
De-weaponizing weather with reality and perspective.
I'll be out with Michael Parker tomorrow, so make sure you give a listen to that, because there is a lot going on as far as hurricanes go. A Hurricane Fiona is a Category 3 hurricane. It's likely to become a Category 4 as it goes by to the west of Bermuda, and it's liable to cause wind gusts to 100 miles an hour at Bermuda. It will then continue northward and hit the Canadian Maritime provinces, most likely as the strongest hurricane ever hit the Canadian Maritime provinces. So Fiona, which was very slow to develop in the tropics, certainly packs a punch. In the meantime, I expect a new storm to develop in the Western Caribbean this weekend, and we're liable to have a major hurricane in the eastern Gulf of Mexico impacting Florida, and then the southeast United States next week. This is WeatherBell.com meteorologist Joe Bastardi for TNT Radio, asking you to enjoy the weather. It's the only weather you've got.
When you remember this year's holiday, will you think of the waves gently lapping on the shore? The sun setting over rolling hills? Or sat bored out of your mind with a flat tire waiting for a recovery truck? One in five motorway breakdowns are caused by tire problems. Before you set off, check your tire pressure. Highways England.
Why listen to TNT Radio? Because friends don't let friends listen to mainstream media. Today's news talk, TNT Radio.
We're on our final stretch with Alan Tonelson of the Reality Check blog. And you mentioned national security at NatCon 3. Apart from Ukraine, was there anything interesting there? Or in your mind, any other important national security issues?
Well, the conference really provided the latest evidence that the American conservative movement is really fully aware that China is going to be the major threat that this country faces, at least through the early decades of this 21st century. In addition, that conservatives are not going to let free trade ideology get in the way of ensuring U.S. national security. This was a big problem that the conservative movement faced, a major split in the conservative movement until very, very recently. And I think that former President Trump deserves full credit for starting the process of making sure that certainly conservatives and, in fact, the entire American body politic got its priorities straight.
Yeah, it looks like we're in for the long haul with China and the Taiwan issue. I mean, I keep reading, I think most recently, that China had for the first time sent a new sort of surveillance drone entering near Taiwanese airspace. So every week we keep hearing about these firsts, this ratcheting up of tensions on all fronts. And I've caught a few of your tweets as well on lithium, which is also a fascinating topic for me, given everything that's going on, energy, the green, the climate agenda. I think last weekend we hit a price high on lithium. I'm not personally a fan of electric vehicles. I was chatting yesterday here on TNT with Chris Rossini, who does the Friday edition of the Liberty Report with Ron Paul, and he was talking about EVs as well, that it's very much a political agenda and that it has little to do with market economics, and it doesn't seem to be accepted by consumers. Even here in a supermarket that I go to in Croatia, in the basement where the parking there's the parking, they actually have a place for charging an EV, and I've not once seen, like, I haven't really seen an EV here. I did, I think, have a neighbor with a Tesla, but I just don't see really people buying into it at the moment. So what are your thoughts on some of the green stuff that's being pushed, lithium, EVs, and this sort of thing?
There's no doubt that there are major obstacles standing in the way of a really widespread electrification of the U.S. automotive market and the global automotive market. At the same time, there's no doubt that the Chinese are buying a lot of electrical vehicles. That's being helped by some pretty generous subsidies from the Chinese regime, and the same thing's happening here in the U.S. Clearly, the Biden administration is all in on electrical vehicles, and what's interesting too is that most of the world's major automakers seem to be pretty enthusiastic about their prospects also, although they would certainly acknowledge that it's going to take quite a few years before we could even think about retiring your standard gasoline engines. So again, I do think that that there's a lot of skepticism justified about this electrification drive, and of course one big obstacle that you just mentioned is that much of what's needed to make electric vehicles profitably comes from China. Not only the lithium, but the batteries that use that lithium, not to mention many parts and components of many of these vehicles. And that's, of course, true for a wide range of so-called clean energy products, whether you're talking about solar panels, whether you're talking about windmills. The Chinese have really stolen the march on clean energy manufacturing. Now, of course, it's a very high stated priority of the Biden administration to change that picture very dramatically and to restore U.S. leadership. And that's, of course, a major aim of the so-called Inflation Reduction Act. It's a major aim of Biden policies pretty much across the whole U.S. government. And we'll see if that works. We'll see if they can achieve this kind of change without bankrupting the rest of the economy. And we'll also see if they can make the so-called transition from an overwhelmingly fossil fuel economy to an overwhelmingly clean energy economy without excessive disruption. And I think that so far, all the evidence is telling us that this is going to be a very difficult challenge indeed.
Something else that you touched on, I think it was from the first day of the conference, was American competition priorities. And so, you know, we're in this struggle, you know, you Cold War, whatever, even, you know, Thucydides trap, but with China, I think for the coming years, it's going to be relegated to the economic and information war space, as well as, you know, manufacturing technology, all of that, before we get close to talking about nukes. And there's talk of decoupling, deglobalization, moving supply chains. I think some stuff has moved out of China to Vietnam, for example, some stuff being moved to Mexico. How do you sort of see things going forward, and what are some things you think maybe the U.S. should or shouldn't do in terms of trying to compete, opening up, closing up, you know, tariffs? As you mentioned, under Trump, he had a certain policy. I think that was then changed. Yeah, your thoughts here.
I think that U.S. decoupling from the Chinese economy has actually made a good deal of progress. If you look at various data like how big of a percentage is two-way U.S.-China trade in terms of the whole U.S. economy, that percentage has gone down quite a bit since the first Trump tariffs were introduced back in early 2018. And you can say the same thing for flows of foreign investment. What we haven't seen nearly enough progress on is stanching U.S. flows of purely financial investment. Americans buying Chinese stocks, American buying Chinese bonds, those flows are still enormous and can only strengthen the Chinese regime both economically and in turn militarily. We have seen more and more U.S. sanctions and tighter export controls on Chinese technology entities, they've been fine as far as they go, but I worry that the kind of a piecemeal approach that they embody is not going to produce fast enough progress against a threat from China that's not piecemeal, that's really systemic. So I think much broader and much more sweeping measures are in fact going to be needed.
Something else I was going to ask you about, and I see that you also touched on in a blog entry, the real extent of DC and New York City hypocrisy about migrant busing.
Oh my goodness. Oh.
Yeah, and you know, this business of shipping migrants all over the country now, Texas and DeSantis, and they're going to Illinois and New York and Martha's Vineyard. And I think we did see some of this liberal hypocrisy where they didn't put their money where their mouth is. And I mean, I can joke, I straight, you know, a decade ago, I went to Mexico and I literally became a Mexican, and I live in a Mexican average working class neighborhood down in Mexico. And so I put my money where the mouth is, but I don't even know what to make of all this. I'm just sitting here kind of bewildered looking at this busing of migrants. What do you make of
it? I think this has been the most brilliant political gambit that the Republicans have come up with in ages. They have made it clear as a bell to any fair-minded, objective observer that when Democratic and progressive and other open borders types prattle on about America's obligation to accept more immigrants, more asylum seekers, more refugees, about the need for more generous policies, more lenient policies, more compassionate policies, more humane policies. What they really mean is those policies and their consequences ought to be limited to you and your states and your cities, not to ours. And what I tried to point out in that reality check post that you talked about was that not only are the Texas border cities in particular where so many of these migrants have been crossing. And of course, we just found out from the U.S. Customs and Border Protection Agency that this fiscal year, the numbers of border apprehensions are going to exceed 2 million people, not to mention 500,000 that haven't been caught, but that these Texas border cities are not only so much smaller than places like New York and Washington and Chicago, although not Martha's Vineyard necessarily, but they're not only so much smaller in terms of their ability to absorb these enormous migrant flows, they are much poorer. They are incredibly poor cities. They have high poverty rates. They have major economic problems of their own. And the idea that they're supposed to bear most of this burden is so laughably hypocritical that it's really, I think, having an effect on U.S. politics.
We're out of time. Thank you, Alan. AlanTonnelson.wordpress.com. Thank you again. I'm out.